This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Henrik. I'm glad you're here today. If you're new to the program, our website, RedIceCreations.com, has more information for you. We're going to continue on the theme of the conspiracy of Jesus Christ today and discuss the reasons why the imperial cult of Rome, with the Flavians at the center, wanted to invent such a character for their own benefit. Joseph Atwill is an independent scholar who has set the world of New Testament scholarship in a new direction. In his book, Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus, Atwill outlines the series of events in Jesus' ministry that are parallels with the events of the battle campaigns of Titus Flavius, as recorded by Josephus Flavius in War of the Jews. Numerous scholars had noticed the parallels between the Gospels and Josephus' work before, but Atwill is the first to notice that all the parallels take place in exact sequence and draw a revolutionary conclusion. He has also a Flavian signature edition of Caesar's Messiah out now. On his website, caesarsmessiah.com, you can read more about the books, see video clips, and much more. Important 2 hours ahead. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Joseph. Great to have you with us today. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. How are you?
I'm fine, and thank you for having me, Henrik.
You bet. This is going to be really interesting. Dovetails with a lot of other programs we've done before on the topic of the origins of Christianity, and specifically now then we're going to look closer at this topic of the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus, and obviously your book about the subject called Caesar's Messiah. We might have some newcomers with us out there. Always good to get them up to speed. Why don't you give us a little bit of a synopsis, if you will, of your thesis, Joseph?
Sure. The primary thesis is simply that a particular group of Caesars, a family known as the Flavians, waged a war with a messianic movement of Jews in the first century. The war occurred between 66 and 73 CE. And following the war, this messianic movement of Jews was still trying to find a way to rebel against the empire. And they produce Christianity at that point, toward the end of the first century, primarily as a way to slow down the missionary activity of this messianic movement. The Gospels themselves, the story of Jesus, was developed by these individuals, and essentially it is a prophecy of their military victories, so that all of the events of Jesus's adult life, from the gathering his disciples and talking about fishing for men at the Sea of Galilee, up to his crucifixion, all of these events are in fact prophecies and representations of military victories of this this family, the Flavians.
And that's a fascinating aspect, because that opens up the door to, obviously, to why they wanted to invent Christianity and put all of this in context. We have this issue of a delay in the timeline, if you will, Joseph. Maybe we can touch upon that first, because that really sets the stage for why, if you will, why this could be a prophecy, because this is actually something that happened earlier.
Right, and this there's several points that people always ask me when they come across my thesis. And one of them is, well, why did they write about a character that who lived between 30 and 33? And it is because they wanted to create a prophecy of their military campaign. And so they developed the prophecy as a new covenant. In other words, the Hebraic religion had an old covenant, the covenant that Moses established with God. And in that covenant, there was a 40-year cycle. There was 40 years from the Passover, where the Jews left Egypt, until they could enter into the promised land 40 years later. The Flavians developed the Gospels to be a mirror of the Old Covenant. So they set the beginning of Jesus' ministry in 30 and ended it in 33, And this was exactly 40 years from when the when Titus came to Jerusalem in 70, and then to the conclusion of the war at 73 with the fall of Masada. The simple way to understand that is just that the crucifixion of Jesus is exactly 40 years to the day from the conclusion of the Roman-Jewish war that the Flavians fought. So they developed a new covenant. The expression New Testament actually means new covenant. And the new covenant had a 40-year cycle from the Passover, which is the Passover meal that Jesus celebrated, which the Gospels record, unto the Promised Land, which essentially is the point where Judea now becomes under the Flavian control. So it's a new covenant that Christianity represents, and it the prophet of the new covenant, Jesus, all of his prophecies look forward 40 years. Jesus talks about the destruction of the Galilean towns. He mentions that Jerusalem will be encircled. He specifically states that the temple and the buildings around it will be razed. And these prophecies then come to pass 40 years later. So it is a little complicated, but when you actually start dissembling it and you see how the linkages of these events how it exists, you can see that it is very, very deliberate. There's no circumstance here whatsoever. Jesus predicts a son of man or a Christ will come before the generation that is alive when he's talking passes away. In Hebraic religion, a generation is 40 years. Mm-hmm. So he is saying that within 40 years, these military events essentially will occur. The Galilean towns destroyed, Jerusalem encircled, temple razed. And he says at that time, a son of man will come. A son of man will make his visitation, and all of these terrible things will occur. So he is the only person that he could be predicting would be Titus Flavius. Now, this is very suspicious because Titus, through his court historians, claimed to be the Jewish Christ. In other words, his court historians, in very plain language, stated that all of the Jewish prophecies, which looked forward to a Christ, predicted the coming of Titus. He was the Christ. And this then links everything together into a perfect, seamless form.
Before we talk a little bit about Titus, and we need to, I guess, address this idea then that is a precursor. Vespasian helped to kind of set the groundwork for this. Maybe we can talk a little bit about him and also, obviously, overall who the Flavians were and what position they had at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very important. The Flavians were three Caesars, a father and two sons. In the Christian religion, they're represented as the Trinity, God the Father, the Son of God, and the Holy or Awful Spirit, which would be Domitian, the youngest son. So Vespasian and Titus were military men that when the Jewish rebellion took place in 66, Nero brought to Rome and ordered them to go into Judea and put down the rebellion by the Messianic movement. And he specifically got these two generals because they were the best he had. They had been fighting against the Druids for more than a decade in Gaul and Brittany and had been completely successful. And there it was also a religious struggle to some extent. And in that case, the father and son, Vespasian and Titus, had been completely successful. So when the Jewish rebellion occurs, Nero gathers the generals to him and he says, look, go down there and clean this mess up. The Flavians came to Judea with an enormous army, 120,000 men. They meant business. And they began in Galilee so that the ministry of Jesus essentially follows their route. And
they began in Galilee. That's a huge army, by the way. That's a huge army.
Yeah, at that time, it was one of the largest armies that ever assembled.
Yeah, wow.
The rebellion that the Jews held in 66 was very, very important to the Roman Empire. Rome at this point was a prison of nations. They had dozens of ethnicities essentially under their control, and they simply couldn't permit one group to leave the empire and establish its own nation state. They had to put the rebellion down in order to keep all of their other nation states quiet. And so this was very serious to them. They put their best generals and their largest army into Judea. They defeated the Messianic movement. And in the middle of the war, Nero died. The Flavians then decided to seize the throne. The Roman lineage of the Julio-Claudians had been the Caesars since Julius Caesar, and for over 100 years. And now the Flavians decided that this line was decadent. You know, you have Caligula and Nero. They don't see these individuals as very effective leaders, or this is at least the story they give. And so they decided to seize the throne. Vespasian's brother was essentially the mayor of Rome, and he led the rebellion against after Nero passed away, against the individuals who wanted to maintain the lineage of the Julio-Claudians. So Vespasian returned to Rome, seized the throne, and he became Caesar. The Julio-Claudians had established the imperial cult, which essentially made Caesar into a god. This was a very important aspect of their controlling the provinces, that Caesar would be seen to have divine properties. And the imperial cult was the largest bureaucracy within the Roman Empire. It spread everywhere. Everywhere that the empire was, there was the cult that worshiped Caesar. And this, in fact, led directly to the outbreak against the Roman Empire by the Jews, because the Caesars demanded that every temple worship them, that would offer sacrifices to an image of Caesar. But the Jews simply could not abide with this condition, and this is what directly led to the rebellion. In other words, Caesar was attempting to be seen as a god, are demanding to be seen by a god as a god by the Jews, and the Jews refusing. So that once the war was over and the Flavians returned to Rome, they decided that they wanted to create a religion that would be a domesticated version of the Messianic movement, that would have a Christ, but the Christ would essentially be a pacifist, that he would make statements like, give to Caesar what is Caesar's in right. terms of money and taxation, and when violence occurred, to turn the other cheek. Now, the character Jesus that they developed is completely unhistorical. He makes no sense, because the line from David of Christ, because all the term Christ means is simply someone who is anointed as king of the Jews, who has a connection in some way to God. This would be a Christ. And all of these individuals who claim lineage from David were warriors, naturally, because David was famous for being a warrior. So you have a lineage of warriors who are kings of the Jews, who are Christ. And this is what the Messianic movement that rebelled from Rome would have expected the Christ to be. The Christ would have been a military leader. So Jesus is a completely unhistorical character from the very beginning, because not only is he not a warrior, but he believes that Roman control is acceptable. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's.
It's really interesting when we put this in context of strategy and tactics when it comes to propaganda, and obviously how the Roman Empire at the time wanted to control and dominate all the regions. One aspect of all this that I've been fascinated with is Rome's focus on Judea. And I was always trying to get a little closer to this, of why they even wanted to, why did they recognize it so much, I guess, is my question. Because it seems like they decided to build and construct and the whole religion just around this. Were the rebellion so strong, were the force so strong from the Jews at the time down there, and therefore they realized, okay, we have to do something about this, otherwise something might go bad here? Or what do you think?
Yes, that's exactly correct. The rebellion by the Jews, even though it is not well documented in history, was the single greatest threat to the Roman Empire they ever faced. There wasn't just one. The rebellion that led to Christianity occurred around 70 CE. But in 115, 45 years later, an enormous rebellion broke out whereby the Messianic movement seized control of Egypt. They actually took control of the breadbasket of Rome. This led to a tremendous response by the Roman Empire. And then finally, in 133, you had the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, which is the final battle of the Messianic movement. And that led to the diaspora, where the Jews were essentially forbidden to ever enter into Judea as long as the Roman Empire lasted. The battle the Bar Kokhba struggle was so brutal. The Romans lost so many soldiers that the normal salutation to Caesar when a general returns from a battle, which states that the general says to Caesar, "I am well, and the troops are well. We hope Caesar is well." This salutation was not given. It was the only time ever in the Roman Empire's history that it wasn't done, because they were afraid that the population of Rome would rebel if they heard that statement, because that so many people had lost sons during the battle. Hmm. They didn't keep records of this, but it's estimated that it was, you know, 100,000 Roman soldiers lost their lives in the struggle. So first of all, the actual battles in Judea were very, very intense. They were certainly the bloodiest of the Roman Empire. But moreover, the Jews were spread throughout the Roman Empire, as much perhaps as 10 to 12% of the population. They were everywhere. And the Romans were afraid that if the Messianic movement's philosophy spread throughout the empire, that they would be facing these rebellions everywhere. The Roman historian, the Flavian historian, Flavius Josephus, recorded that the thing that most frightened the Caesars was the missionary activity of the Messianic movement. They were afraid that these missionaries would spread this violent, militaristic version of Christianity everywhere. So the religion, Christianity, was really developed as a kind of theological barrier. They simply wanted to make it more difficult for them to spread the military idea of Christ by having a Christ already in place who was a pacifist.
So you use the energy and the force of a grassroots movement of sorts, and then you use it towards for your own advantage. It's a brilliant strategy.
That's very well stated. That's exactly what the Romans did. And they also developed rabbinical Judaism. Rabbinical Judaism had a number of differences to the form of Judaism, particularly the kind that you can see in the Dead Sea Scrolls and certainly the Messianic movement that rebelled. And so what Rome did was they created two kinds of Judaism, because they knew they couldn't get rid of it. So they had for the traditional Judaism was rabbinical Judaism, which they controlled. And this had the Messiah extracted. There was no messianic fervor in rabbinical Judaism. Mm. But for those that were looking for a Messiah, they had Christianity. So what they had done is they simply had divided Judaism into easy to control components.
So again, if you can't beat them, join them. Use your own theology to your advantage. We need to understand a little bit here then, because we know about the Council of Nicaea. We understand around 300-ish, 25 or so. We have a conversion, if you will, then with the Constantine over to Christianity. But from 115 that you mentioned, we have a true movement here then of sorts. And some way along the line, it gets hijacked, if you will, by Rome. What happened? How much do we know there?
Very little. The the documents that are from Christianity during this era are, in my opinion, virtually all frauds. They were written, in other words, by individuals who were not sincere Christians, because the Roman bureaucracy was controlling the religion, and therefore it was controlling the literature. The literature was very, very important. It was the only, it was a primary way that ideas could spread. And so Rome naturally had a very clear idea about what kind of literature it wanted to be in circulation. It's very interesting that until the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, there had never been a single scrap, not one scrap of written literature from the Messianic movement in this era had ever been found. There wasn't, in fact, it was such a blackout that a number of scholars were putting forward the idea that the Jews had become illiterate, and simply there were no documents being produced during this era. But when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, then suddenly you got a chance to see the real Jewish voice. And it was extremely militaristic, and the Christ was very violent, and they were xenophobic and wanted to drive the foreigners out of Judea. So what the reason why there is such a historical blackout until Constantine essentially makes Christianity the state religion is because Rome was destroying all of the literature of the era that it in any way saw as subversive.
Yeah. And this is true, by the way, Joseph, you know, in so many other regions around Europe as well, as you mentioned before, with the Druids or the Celts, the Goths. And yeah. We don't have anything written down except the few texts that come to us from some of the Roman scribes, which is propaganda in most cases.
Exactly. And I think that what Rome did was essentially destroy all literature that it saw in any way as subversive. And that could be as general as simply promoting ethnic identity. There is nothing left of this whole era of European and Judaic history. It's gone. And all we have left are the zany Christian theologians and a few very cynical Roman philosophers. And it's all propaganda. So we lost this whole history. And in fact, one of the points that I think is sort of interesting about decoding the Gospels so that you can actually see the real history is that they actually do put a little bit of light on a missing history. We get to actually see what was behind the origins of Christianity and what Rome was really doing during that time.
So do you think that the Flavians could have pulled all of this off without Flavius Josephus? And obviously we need to detail his name because he's an adopted member of the imperial family. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, Josephus is the court historian of the Flavian dynasty. He wrote the official history of the war with the Jews. He was a Jew, at least if you accept him as a historical character. The details that he claims for himself are extraordinary. He was a child prodigy. He was a member of all of the different sects of the Jewish religion. And then, amazingly, he was a general of the rebellion against Rome. He was captured by the Flavians. He then had a communication with God, whereby God told him that the covenant that he had established with the Jews was now broken and that the Romans would be receiving the new covenant, the New Testament. He then decided that all of the Messianic prophecies, which had foreseen a Jewish Christ, were incorrect, that the real Christ was, in fact, the Flavian Caesar. So then Josephus, following the war, produced the history of the war. And an interesting point is that until very recently, Christian scholarship had accepted that all of Jesus's prophecies were about the war. There was a group of Christian theologians that were quite dominant. They were called the Preterites. And they saw what was very obvious, which is that when Jesus states that the Galilean towns will be crushed, for example, he's foreseeing the events of the war. And so in the very early printed editions of the New Testament, they would actually include Josephus's work. It was as if it was another book of the New Testament. That sort of came to an end in the 19th century, but Josephus was his work was seen as the fulfillment of the prophecies that Jesus made. In other words, Jesus predicted and the historian recorded that Jesus's prophecy had come to pass. So Josephus is, an amazingly suspicious character in my mind. Mm-hmm. I do not believe his background is plausible. I see him as simply as a nom de plume. His miracle capacity, his ability to see into the future and determine that the Flavians would become Caesar and that they would become Christ, this is, obviously very similar to the prophecies that Jesus makes. Mm. And so I would also point out that in terms of the technical ability of writing the Gospels, the Flavians were allied with two families, the Herods and the Alexanders. The Herods, most people know about. The Alexanders are not as well known, but are very, very important. They were a Jewish family. They were the wealthiest family in the world. They were the Rome's tax collector of Egypt, the area of Egypt. One of them was Philo Alexander, who was the most famous Jewish intellectual of the era. Philo's brother had a son, Tiberius, who was the primary general of the Flavians against the Messianic movement. So in other words, this family of Jewish intellectuals abandoned their religion and their people and came to work for the Flavians. So this was where the technical ability to produce the Gospels came from.
So what do you think the perception, it's impossible to know, I guess, but at the time was, I mean, they must have been perceived as turncoats, if you will. I mean, at the time, do you think anyone listened or believed the stories or the propaganda that began to coalesce at the time?
No, I think that the Gospels were not written for Jewish zealots, and they were not written for Jews that were religious and familiar with the Torah. They were simply written for hoi polloi, for illiterate slaves that would essentially believe any fantasy if it was told by a person of authority. I think that the stories are very implausible and, in fact, are a kind of Roman humor. The cognoscenti level of the Roman Empire, Jews and Gentile patricians, would have thought these stories were ludicrous and would have laughed at them. I think an honest appraisal of the story, even absent the kind of analysis that I produce showing that the stories are a representation of the Flavian military victories, any honest appraisal of the stories are that they are absurd and unhistorical, they're comical. This is not religious literature.
Do you think that it was a secondary agenda that they also ended up, at the end of the day, to control a large part of the world with this fictional story?
I think that they developed the religion with the idea of pacifying the population. And I think that if you look at the Flavians, if you actually study how they kept power, they were the group of Caesars that most developed the concept of bread and circuses. They produced, they built the Colosseum, for example, and they put on these mass spectacles intended to distract the population from the fact that they were slaves. And Christianity works in the same method. In other words, they definitely intended that this religion would be something that would control the population that succumbed to the theology. But I don't think in the first century they were intending to use the religion as a empire-wide phenomena. The individual who actually made that decision was Flavius Constantine. Now, there aren't any direct genealogical linkages from Constantine backwards to the original Flavians, but he does have their same name. And when he created his sacred arch directly outside the Colosseum, he linked it, essentially, in other words, it's in a straight line, with the Arch of Titus and the Arch of Vespasian. So in other words, he saw himself, or he was making a representation of himself, as being in the religious lineage of the original Flavians. And I believe he was a family member, and I believe that the reason he selected Christianity as the state religion, because there were numerous religions he could have chosen from.
Yeah.
But this particular religion was his family's cult. In other words, the story of Jesus is actually a representation of the divinity of the Flavian family. This is the hard to understand but absolutely critical point, is that once you understand the typology, and I know the word is not well understood, but when you understand the genre of the Gospels, you can see that the authors are making a very specific point that the Flavians were divine. And this is the reason that Constantine chose this particular religion and this particular canon to use as the state religion, because it was his family's cult, and it represented his family as divine.
So we know that through many ecumenical councils, the story has been rewritten and so forth. It's taken a long time to get us the Bible that we have today, and it might have looked different back then. But what do you know when it comes to the creation of the story, how much the scribes at the time then borrowed from other, you know, mythological stories? Did they borrow anything from the Druids, something from the Goths, a little bit from the Judaic? What do you know?
Well, their thought world contained the religions that they were familiar with. So they're, but in fact, the Gospels were not redacted or changed and are very, very precise. The typology is in a very precise sequence. And if someone had changed the storyline of the Gospels or had edited it very severely, the typology would not link perfectly to the story that, or the history that Flavius Josephus recorded. I think that scholars who believe that the Gospels are a mishmash of editing and redaction are wrong, and that I can demonstrate this. I can actually prove that the earliest versions of the Gospels that we have, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, are perfect storyline alignment to Flavius Josephus. So what occurred was the Flavians, and excuse me, Constantine in 305 ordered that a number of copies of the Gospels be produced. At that point, the Gospels were completely codified, but the version that he was using was the original version, more or less. In other words, there was some editing to it, of course, but the editing was always done with the awareness of the original intent of the Gospels. There are some micro typology examples. I mean, for example, the pre-ministry of Jesus, where you have seven events which are in a very precise sequence, and this is not something that is controvertible. In other words, it's not my analysis. It's just known to Christian scholars. But had any of those events been placed in a different order, or if they'd been taken out, then the entire typologic system would have collapsed. So this shows that the Gospels were not heavily redacted. Some of the elements that people think of in terms of Jesus, for example, his birthday on December 25th, or a few other elements, they see them as coming from the original version of Christianity. But these aren't from the Gospels themselves. These were just attributes that were given to Jesus later on.
Right. That's true. So what about Mithraism, for example, then? Is this something that comes into the picture a little bit later as well, where Rome begins to shape it around some of their own traditions? Or,
well, the Mithraic traditions, the sacraments, and I think some of the structure of their theology ends up in Christianity. But these are not aspects that come from the Gospels. These are simply, you know, the form of the religion, the vestments and the locations of the religion, where they actually have their, you know, the churches. I think they took over quite a few of the of Mithras churches and made them into Christian churches. But the literature itself, the canon, is very precise, and the typologic system that links the history of Josephus to the Gospels is so precise and so dense that it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the literature was not heavily redacted. We have the original literature. The Gospels, what they really are, is not religious texts, even though that's how they're always seen. It's really a manifestation of the Flavian divinity. So if you look at the Flavians and the religious artifacts that they developed, they are enormous and very expensive and very elaborate, and they all proclaim the divinity of the family. The Gospel is just a literary version of, for example, the Arch of Titus. So the Gospels were not something that they would have ever permitted to have been, you know, heavily overwritten.
Right.
One of the reasons that people even have this notion is because they have this idea that there is some history in the Gospels, that there was, you know, a Mark or a Luke, and that these scribes are developing a text, and that therefore the text could have been changed by other iterations of Christian communities, you know, as the religion developed. But once you realize that the literature was produced by the Caesars, then it takes on a whole different dimension. In other words, it's at that point you realize, no, this is not something that would have been changed or redacted. This was protected by the Caesar's vanity, and that was the most powerful force in the world at that time.
So there are other authors, obviously, that have discovered this, but in terms of you know, some of the other scholars out there that are really looking into this, they haven't really, far as I know, found any evidence for this. Why is that, do you think? What makes you being able to pull this out while they can't?
It's very interesting. A number of the parallels have been discovered. I could list probably a dozen of the parallels between the war and the Gospels that other scholars have identified, but they fail to recognize that they're occurring in the same sequence. And this is because they have training in history or in religion, but not in literary analysis. They simply don't have training in how to determine the genre, the basic genre that the literature represents. I just in a very simple form, the first thing that someone needs to do to link Titus's campaign to the Gospels is simply to take the events that are the same thing. You don't have to get into any of the exotic parallels or even any simple parallels. You simply look at what is the same. And when you start to identify, you know, things like the encircling of Jerusalem with a wall, the razing of the temple, the abomination of desolation, the destruction of the Galilean towns, journey, for example, from Galilee to Jerusalem, period of time outside of the city. When you just take that much and start to place one event next to its pair, its twin, you start to realize that there is a sequence. And in literature, there are many unusual parallels. There's a famous set, I don't know if in Europe it's well known, but that links Kennedy to Lincoln. There are all sorts of parallels between,
That's a fantastic story, famous. That one, by the way, yeah.
But they don't occur in the same sequence. And this is because unusual events will not occur in sequence by definition. It's impossible. This is the same principle, for example, that enables someone to use DNA evidence to convict a person of committing a crime. So sequence is very, very unusual, and unusual parallels will not occur in the same sequence. So once you have that foundation of just the obvious same events occurring, and you see the sequence, and then you start placing the other parallels into place, parallels that other scholars have noticed, you'll see that long before you get to the more exotic parallels, some of the ones that I identify and explain how they operate, long before you get there, you've already established dependency. You've already shown, without a doubt, that the adult ministry of Jesus was not an original work. It isn't a history. It is completely developed from the military campaign of Titus Flavius.
And within this structure as well, you found that there actually is a skillful satire that has been incorporated into the Gospels as well. Tell us about that.
Well, they take the events from Titus' campaign, and then they will create what I call a typologic pair. One of these would be, for example, the very beginning of the ministry, a very simple one. The system that they develop in the Gospel uses location, names, concepts occurring in the same sequence. So at the beginning of Jesus's ministry, he comes to the Sea of Galilee. He gathers his disciples together and he says, "Follow me. Don't be afraid. You will become fishers of men." Very famous episode. If you are mapping Jesus's ministry on a Titus's campaign, you begin at the beginning and you say, well, what does Titus do at the beginning of his military campaign? What you'll find is he comes to the same location. He comes to the Sea of Galilee. He gathers his disciples, his legions around him, and he says, "Do not be afraid and follow me." They attack the Jewish fishing fleet, sink the boats, and catch them like fish. So now, in typological parallelism, it's never verbatim. There's always an element of concept that you have to sort of grasp the actual connection between the two events. Mm. But the sequence keeps you in focus the entire time, because it is certainly the case, even though you can dispute that this particular parallel was deliberately created, it certainly is the closest concept in Titus's campaign to that event in Jesus's ministry. I mean, this is self-evident. There would be no other event even at the Sea of Galilee other than this particular one. So it's the closest one. And so this then, in terms of the probability, it's unusual that it would occur at the same point in the ministry. So now as you walk through Jesus's ministry, you start realizing that virtually every single event, while not perfectly verbatim, can be seen as very similar in an odd way to an event that Titus is having at the same location. And then at a certain point, probability sets in, because these unusual parallels, and by the way, I mean, this can be demonstrated mathematically. It's a little complicated, but it isn't that hard. I mean, any high school history class could essentially demonstrate the dependency between Titus's campaign and Josephus's history. You'd simply have to come up with a fraction that would represent how unusual parallels that can be seen by a non-random number of people, how unusual are they? And then when you see the overall pattern between Jesus and Titus, you'd simply recognize immediately that this could not possibly be accidental. So it's quite demonstrable, and it's quite easy for anyone who wants to put a little bit of time in to absolutely verify that Jesus's ministry is not history. It is typologic comedy that foresees not a Jew, but rather a Roman Caesar. The key to the Gospels is Jesus's prophecy about this individual who's going to come in 40 years. Over and over again, Jesus makes prophecies regarding someone that he calls the Son of Man. And he describes this individual in the third person. He says, the Son of Man's going to come, and this will happen, and that will happen, all these bad things. These apocalyptic events will occur. Well, it's not very complicated. It's in fact the only coherent way that the text can be read. The interpretation I'm presenting is not exotic. On the contrary, it's the only coherent way the text can be understood. Jesus is flatly predicting that someone's going to come in 40 years and do these things, and there's only one individual it could possibly be. That's Titus Flavius.
Yeah, it's amazing that when you think about it this way. So they leave this in here as a clue, obviously, to who?
Well, the Gospels are a literary version of the Arch of Titus, and I would hope every person who listens to this would simply go on the internet and look at the Arch of Titus, because what you'll see are a lot of the events that Jesus predicted being brought to pass by Titus Flavius. And then you'll see the inscriptions stating that these events were brought about by God the Father, Vespasian, through the actions of God the Son, Titus Flavius.
Titus, yeah.
In other words, the Gospels are written to everyone, and they are the same. They were created through the same energy, the same vanity that produced all of the enormous building constructions that the Flavians produced during this era. They were obsessed with their divinity. It was, from what I can gather, the most important concept that they held. And so the Gospels are simply a way to show posterity that, in fact, they were gods and that they did force the Jews to worship them. They simply didn't tell them the name of the Son of Man that Jesus predicted. If the texts were written, instead of where Jesus says the Son of Man will come and do this and that, if he simply said, and Titus Flavius the Christ will come and destroy Galilee and he'll encircle Jerusalem, et cetera, then there wouldn't be much to wonder about, would there?
Yeah,
it would just be completely clear. So this now then, you know, you start getting into, well, how close are the history of Christianity to what goes on in the Gospels? Remember, the Pontiff Maximus, the individual that takes over the control of the religion, I mean, Pontiff Maximus is simply another title for Caesar. That was one of his official titles. So what Caesar has done is he has expanded the imperial cult into a particular religion. He has retained his title, and now the hoi polloi, the slaves, are not permitted to rebel, because if they do, it's against God himself. See, this is the whole purpose here. So on one hand, they want to tell posterity about their divinity, and then on the other hand, they want to have the power of God on the planet under their control so they can create obedience. I want to explain and give examples of what the typologic genre is. The Gospels can be understood instantly once you make this understanding of the genre itself. Typology is simply basing one story on another. And a typologic link is simply a link between two characters that has enough similarity so that a reader can identify that one character has some kind of linkage to the other. It's not verbatim. These parallels are not perfect. There's always differences, but there is enough similarity between the two stories so that an alert reader can recognize that there is some parallelism. And then once he sees the overall pattern, the long sequence, then the entire connection, the typologic system becomes clear. And I'll just read a very, very short example of this. This is Josephus's description of an event following the war. In other words, after the temple has been razed and after the Last Supper, you have this event that Josephus records. He says that I went to a certain village called Thekoa in order to know if it was a fit place for a camp. I saw many captives crucified and remembered three of them as my former acquaintance. I was very sorry at this in my mind and went with tears in my eyes to Titus and told him of them. So he immediately commanded them to be taken down and to have the greatest care taken of them in order that they could recover. Yet two of them died while the third recovered. Now, that story has strange similarities to the story in the gospel where Jesus is crucified in a group of three. Hmm. The Roman commander is begged that he could be brought down from the cross. And two of them died, presumably, and one amazingly recovered. But if you look deeper into the story, you can see that the character in the gospel, whose job description is good counselor, is very similar to the individual here who asked the Roman commander to take them down from the cross. They have the same first name, Joseph. Now the last name. In the Gospels, the character is called Joseph of Arimathea. This character, the character Josephus, his last name is Bar-Matthias. And if you overlaid the Greek on top of it, you would see that it's actually only one letter is removed from Josephus's last name to create the name Arimathea. And that is typology. It is not precisely identical, but there is enough similarity. Joseph of Arimathea or Joseph Bar-Matthias, that an alert reader would say that is strange. That's all that is needed for typologic connection. It's just that there is enough parallelism that you would notice it if you were looking for it. And now from that point, you can then go to all of the events in the ministry of Jesus and start doing the same process of connecting them. And you'll see that you'll have an enormous sequence of events, 50 events that are actually in the same sequence that have these kinds of parallels that are both some completely overt and others a little more subtle, like the last name of the character Joseph of Arimathea.
Quick follow-up note on that. Have you gone through them all, Joseph, or are there still some things missing, so to speak?
Well, the typology in the Gospels is actually a mockery of the Hebraic typology that we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which if you're familiar with them, these would be the Pesherim. And that typology is very mysterious. There are numbers, puzzles, and there's conceptual puzzles. And I think that there are levels in the Gospels that are actually very deep, but just the basic concept of linking Jesus to Titus is very simple, and a reader can do it with maybe 30 or 40 minutes of work. I mean, I'll give you an example of the deeper level. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, the group that is writing the literature refers to themselves as the builders. They say they are the builders. In the Gospel and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they have lots of Masonic imagery. You have cornerstones and angles, and the builders are essentially making a path for God to come with their building. In the Gospels, Jesus is called a tecton, which is translated as carpenter, but in fact, it actually means stonemason or mason. And Jesus is stated to be the cornerstone that the builders rejected. So what they're doing is the Romans are representing this struggle that they're having with the group called the builders or the tectons. With this description of Jesus, all of the stone imagery. For example, his chief disciple Simon being named Peter or Stone. This relates back to the mason imagery in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And just to give you an example of like how deep and how promising this would be as an area of research. In the in Greek today, the word tecton, which is Jesus's father's job description, and Jesus is also called a tecton at one point. That is the word that is used for Freemason.
That's right.
In Greece today, so you can see that the depth of the symbolism can be quite deep. I don't really. Want to go into too much of that kind of analysis because the information I bring is hard for people to accept. They have an iconic image of Jesus. To so many people, the individual lives in their mind. He's essentially as real as their family members. And so when you bring something as revolutionary as the idea that this is a comedy and this is a fictional character, this Jesus character, and it can be demonstrated, I think that that's really where I want my analysis to reside, is in that simple truth, because that's really the beginning of everything. If you can understand that simple level of the Gospels, then the other levels will eventually become clear, but they're not as important as just that straightforward, simple one.
Absolutely fascinating. There's so much more to discuss about all of this. Of course, Joseph, we're going to carry on here in the next segment to do so. Why don't we talk a little bit about your website, though, and obviously your book with the title Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus. The website that people can go to is simply caesarsmessiah.com. We will have it up there. But tell us a bit more about the site and the book, if you will, Joseph.
Sure. The current edition is a new one. My work is ongoing. I brought out an original version of Caesar's Messiah in English in 2006 and under a German, in the German language, in 2009, I believe. In the German edition is called Das Messias Ratzel. But I had, in the meantime, I had discovered a much deeper level and more easy to understand level of typology linking Titus and Jesus, which I call the Flavian signature. And that book I have now released it. It is available on the website. It's called the Flavian signature. That's the little name I gave this particular discovery, because it is essentially the signature of the Flavians in the Gospels, that they wrote it. So the Caesar's Messiah is available on the website. I hope that people do read the work, because I think that this is it's important historical information, but it's also very useful in terms of understanding the mass that governments use in general to control population.
Absolutely. And the first book, Caesar's Messiah, that was out, the first edition, that sold out and out of print, I think, but that was back in, when did you first release that, Joseph?
I released the book in 2006, and it didn't sell much at all in the first year, but started to pick up steam and eventually became, at least on the internet, the best-selling book of Christian history in the United States. When the German edition came out, I was able to use the royalties from the English sales and also from the German edition to buy back the rights. I wanted to control the rights. I thought it was valuable, and I thought that the arrangement I had under my first edition was not in my favor, and so I bought the rights back, so the book was no longer available in English. I then worked with individuals that I produced the documentary with, Fritz Heed and Neola Sparkus, to edit and bring out the Flavian edition of Caesar's Messiah. And basically, the book is a complement to the documentary, which will soon be released.
That's right. And we're going to return and talk more about that specifically, because it's a great documentary. We're going to have Fritz with us as well to discuss that. But that's at a later date. And so in the meantime, yes, we refer people to the website, caesarsmessiah.com. And you have it still as an ebook, right? But the Flavian signature, that's a hard copy or a book more.
You can buy it either as an ebook or a hard copy. It's available in either form. You can buy it on Kindle and all different manners. And it's ready to go. I think just based on the response I'm getting from readers, that I can almost guarantee people will find it interesting.
It is very interesting indeed, and more coming up after the break. So stay with us, Joseph. We'll be right back.
Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there. Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone, by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. Take second best, put me to the test. Things on your chest, you need to confess. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone to care. Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone, by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith.
We go deeper into the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus with Joseph Atwill in the second hour, right now, in our member section. We discuss the feudal era, the Dark Ages, root of government control and crowd control coming out of Rome. We ask, why was this story so successful over the rest of the world when it was intended to be primarily at the time sold to Judea? Furthermore, the messianic story wasn't a big success at the end of the day for the Jews. So what happened? Atwill argues that the Judaism at the time of David, the alleged second king of the United Kingdom of Israel, was a very different one, and that the Dead Sea Scrolls reveals some of this. Much more is coming up, and you shouldn't miss this fascinating research from Joseph. Stream or download from our member section on redicecreations.com. If you're yet not a member, try it out. 15 euros for 3 months. We have a few different subscription options available for you. The site is tested with the latest iPhones and iPads. It works fine. We also have an app for easy access and RSS feeds with both hours. We've done some great updates lately and more is coming. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Andrew Goff, Anthony Peake, Carl Munk, Sonia Barrett, Dean Clifford, Barbara Handclo, Håkan Blomqvist, Gerard Williams, Paul Levy, Laird Scranton, Louise Turi, and many more coming up. You're welcome to tune in then. But right now, we'll proceed on the topic of Caesar's Messiah in Hour 2. We'll see you on the other side.